What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
For years, the Trailhead Nest had been protected by a 10,000-member force. 15% of its adult members were soldiers. A soldier's exoskeleton, twice the size of that of an ordinary worker, is literally heavy armor, thick, tough, and pitted in places for resilience and strength. A pair of spines project backward from the midsection of the body to protect the waist. Spikes protect the neck, and the rear margin of the head is curved forward, forming a helmet.
When attacked, the soldier can pull in her legs and antenna and tighten up the segments of her body, turning her entire surface into a shield. The ordinary trailhead workers, while built for labor, were also available for combat. They served as the light infantry, using the swiftness and the agility of their supple bodies to dart in and out of enemy lines, seizing any leg or antenna available and holding on to it until their nest mates could close in and grab another body part. When the adversary was finally pinned and spread-eagled, others piled on to bite, sting, or spray her with poison.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and today it's ants, folks.
That's right. This is going to be Ant Wars, Episode 1. The Antpire Strikes Back, perhaps. I'm not sure. I haven't worked out the full title yet. But yeah, we're going to be taking a couple of episodes to look at the wars of the ants. And it seemed ideal that we kick off with a cold reading from the novel Anthill, a novel by E.O. Wilson, which came out in 2010.
So we were talking about this novel before we got started. It actually got some surprisingly good reviews. I was thinking about picking up a copy and reading it until I discovered that a significant portion of this novel is about human characters. And I was hoping with E.O. Wilson, you know, especially in the past, we've talked about that video where he like plunges his hand into a nest of fire ants and beams with the most radiant joy as the ants all bite and sting him at the same time. I was hoping it would be all about ants, because if anybody could do ants as compelling central characters, I would think it would be E.O. Wilson.
Yeah, I think I was looking at one review of it that was glowing that said that there are about 70 pages in the novel that only E.O. Wilson could have written. And I think this gives everyone a little taste of that. And when we say, you know, surprisingly, you know, great reviews, you know, it's obviously E.O. Wilson is a tremendous author, but generally he is associated with nonfiction,
right?
Oftentimes conveying science very effectively to a general audience. But of course, fiction is a slightly different scenario. So you might expect even a very talented nonfiction writer, you know, to perhaps stumble a bit in trying to create a work of fiction like this.
Oh, totally. That's what I mean. I didn't mean like E.O. Wilson's a dummy. I just meant that usually when somebody who's not primarily a fiction writer is like, yeah, I'll do a novel, it's not always great.
Well, you know, the main example that always comes to my mind would be the Tech Wars novels that were attributed to William Shatner. Though I understand it was more of a ghostwriting scenario,
right,
that was in place.
There was some spiritual composition involved,
but I have to say it was not the Tech Wars that inspired me to seek this topic out this week, but rather the Clone Wars. And also the miniature board gaming in general. So my son and I recently ordered a copy of Fantasy Flight Star Wars Legion miniature game, which is a miniature war game in the tradition of things like, say, Warhammer 40,000, and then the older like Napoleonic war games of old, the kind of thing that has been the pastime of people such as H.G. Wells, who wrote essentially a rule book for such miniature gaming, and then was also a favorite pastime of Peter Cushing.
Right. You recently shared this video with me where Cushing is painting his little figurines. I guess it's Napoleonic Wars or some similar temporal event where all these little uniformed figures, he's like posing them around barns and stuff that he's got on his floor. I think it was a video from the 1950s that was documented.
Yeah, it was 1950s. And yeah, he's really getting into it. He has a whole hobby set up. And yeah, then he's laying them out on the floor, getting them into position. You know, very, very historical based for sure. But yeah, just thinking about this sort of thing, thinking about miniature gaming in general, and thinking about the Clone Wars, where you have on one side a bunch of genetically identical warriors going up against armored robotic hordes. I couldn't help but think of the ants, the wars of the ants.
You know, it's amazing how much Hymenopteran conflict we can miss because you're just going about your business. Maybe you're doing something in your yard, you're hanging out in the sun or in the hammock or something, and you don't even realize that there is literally a battle raging just a couple of feet from you around the blades of grass.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the ants are waging their wars. They're defending their territories. And we're talking about against other ants. They're not even talking about their various struggles against other species. And it's everywhere. We tend not to even think about our ants unless they actually invade our homes. And then we get hot and bothered about it. But I imagine the most crucial question we have to consider before we proceed is, can we really consider the conflict we see between ant species, between different ant colonies, as warfare, more or less in the human sense of the word?
Well, I mean, in one sense, you could say maybe pedantically and obviously no, because it would necessarily fail to capture like the full range of human value and culture and passion that accompanies conflict between humans. But on the other hand, I think you could absolutely probably like see some parallels in terms of like pure resource dynamics.
Yeah, I was thinking about this a little bit. Sometimes you see war defined as a declared armed hostile conflict. And of course, the idea of ants actually declaring war on another group of ants is ridiculous because you're getting into declarations of war. That's a human political reality. And as Dr. Brundle would probably remind us, insects are rather short on politics.
I mean, I think that fails to capture even a lot of actual war in the human context, where a lot of wars are not called wars by the people carrying them out.
Right. Another issue, too, is if we're talking about an armed hostile conflict, well, ants, don't actually take up arms in the human sense. And of course, they don't have to, because ants have a number of biological weapons and chemical weapons at their disposal that make such tool use unnecessary. And of course, we'll be running through some examples of these bioweapons as we proceed through these episodes. However, we do tend to discuss these conflicts between ant colonies, between ant species, as being a form of war, something that we can think of as war. As zoologist and entomologist Sean O'Donnell pointed out on Serious Science, ants engage in, quote, direct aggressive interaction between ants of different colonies. They also engage in such conflict over resources. And as a noted ant expert, author of The Human Swarm, tropical biologist Mark W. Moffat has put it, war is, quote, the concentrated engagement of group against group in which both sides risk wholesale destruction. So it's easy to look at other animals, perhaps, and say, well, cats don't wage war, dogs don't wage war. It would be, for instance, kind of ridiculous to say that lions are waging war against, say, an antelope, right?
Yeah, I think that the analogy would really fall short there.
But for the ant, however, it gets a little different. So Moffat contends that the case for ant warfare is fairly convincing. It's not simply a matter of applying the lens of human civilization to the behavior of animals. What they are doing, and we humans have done for thousands of years, are both endeavors that entail, quote, an astonishing array of tactical choices about methods of attack and strategic decisions about when and where to wage war.
Now, the parallel there gets especially interesting because while humans would have to make tactical and strategic choices in organized conflict consciously, you know, they'd have to, like, mm-hmm. use their brains, look at what's going on and try to judge. I think we would have to say that the ant carries out its campaigns almost entirely on instinct. Like, the ant doesn't have strategic theories except what it naturally does by instinctive behavior.
That's right. Yeah, they more or less simply do. And we'll get into some of the details of that here in a second. I want to throw in that Douglas J. Emlen, who wrote an excellent book several years ago titled Animal Weapons, he weighs in on this and says that, okay, for the most part, animals do not fight battles or wars. And, you know, he says most of the animal conflict that we see in the wild, it's ultimately more of a duel, you know, especially as far as intraspecies contests go, you know, like male fighting a male over a potential mate. But ants and termites are certainly examples of something that could be a standout, you know, in which we do see this kind of large-scale war with high stakes for both sides. You know, I was thinking a bit about this, too, that, you know, even these other scenarios, lions versus antelopes and all, like at best we could maybe think of that as a skirmish, right? But certainly not a war, certainly not a war of eradication.
Yeah, I would say that the conflicts between most animals you see in nature are much more individual. They're less group-oriented. They're less organized. Though at the same time, that brings up an interesting question about what really counts as an individual when you're talking about something like a colony of ants. Mm-hmm. Because unlike, say, mammals or birds or something, ants are a situation where within the colony, it gets harder to make the case that the individual ant's body is a like independent autonomous agent. And it might be better thought of as like one organ of the actual individual, which is the overall colony.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that they are so, I mean, they're eusocial insects and they're so connected that there is this sense of civilization to them, you know? They are, you know, they're managing resources, in some cases, such as the leafcutter ant, they're engaging in agriculture, you know? There's this whole system that is there that makes the argument for ant warfare a lot more convincing than saying, well, this invasive species is waging a war on the native species. Yeah, I mean, it is out competing it for some resource, but it is not like this tight-knit unit. It is not a full-blown colony. Now, obviously, nothing humans do is going to be 100% comparable to something in the ant world, but the similarities are pretty startling. I want to read a quote from a wonderful 2011 Scientific American article titled Ants and the Art of War, and this is also by Mark W. Moffat. Quote, scientists have long known that certain kinds of ants and termites form tight-knit societies with members numbering in the millions, and that these insects engage in complex behaviors. Such practices include traffic control, public health efforts, crop domestication, and perhaps most intriguingly, warfare, the concentrated engagement of group against group in which both sides risk wholesale destruction. Indeed, in these respects and others, we modern humans more closely resemble ants than our closest living relatives, the apes, which live in far smaller societies.
So the main similarity between us and the ants is that we organize ourselves more so than almost any other non-insect animal.
Right. Now, biologically, of course, we're much larger vertebrates. We have impressive brains that have enabled us to achieve unequaled technological accomplishments, including but not limited to the production of 1954's Them and Bird Eye Gordon's 1977 film Empire of the Ants. You don't see the ants themselves making films this good.
That's true. Ant cinema is rather lacking, though I don't know if I've seen this Bird Eye Gordon movie or not. Of course, Bird Eye Gordon has come up on the show several times. He's sort of aka Mr. Big. He's the king of the forced perspective effect where, you know, you take like a lizard and then you shoot it up close against a background and make it say that it's a dinosaur.
Yeah, I have to say, I haven't seen Empire of the Ants either. I mainly know it because it's referenced in a Warren Zevon song. But it's a 1977 release. That's pretty late in the Bird Eye Gordon giant animal rampaging world, I would think.
Last time I checked, Bird Eye Gordon was still alive. I think he is.
Oh, wow. Still going at it.
Yes, he's 97 years old.
All right, so obviously ants can't actually top that. You know, they don't have language, they don't have civilization in the sense that we do. Ants, however, they have a different way of going about things. So, for instance, they produce, while we're like a 50-50 male-female species, ants only produce males to serve as short-lived reproductive drones to fertile queens.
That's right. I mean, ants are females, basically.
Yes. Yeah, the vast majority of the colony consists of sterile females. And while the queen terminology, you know, often we talk about the queen ant, and it brings with it the legacy of human centralized power structures. Ultimately, ants function without a power hierarchy or a permanent leader. They are entirely decentralized. So like you said earlier, combat decisions, they're not made by commanders. You know, if this was a miniature war game, you wouldn't have like the commander piece that's essential for all of this to take place. No, it's rather a case of swarm intelligence.
That is one of the hardest things to keep in mind, because there's this natural tendency we have to assume that something called the queen is in charge. But yeah, when you're thinking about ants, you have to remember that basically ants are always at war and the queen is never in command. The queen doesn't tell the ants what to do. They are highly motivated to protect the queen, but that's kind of in the same way that like you are highly motivated to protect the most vulnerable parts of your body from injury, right? Like you'd protect your face and stuff. Like the queen is their reproductive chances, and that's why she is protected.
Right. Yeah. And she is very important. There are some passages in E.O. Wilson's novel where the tragedy of the fall of their queen is discussed, and how this is part of the peril that this key group of ants finds themselves in. But ultimately, the wars of ants and the wars of humans, they're often fought for the same reasons: territory, food, ideal dwelling spaces, and even labor. So some ant species do, in fact, employ something that we might think of as slave labor. And we'll come back to that as we go. But also, ants deploy various tactics depending on what is at stake. So, like, you know, not every war is equal to the ant colony. There is there's a fluctuation in the amount of effort that is put into it, how much ant power is put on the line, etc. However, in his book, The Human Swarm, Moffat speaks a little bit more about this, about the basic comparison between human and ant warfare. And he does write that, quote, "If nothing else, remember this. Comparing identical things is deadly boring. Making comparisons is most fruitful when parallels are noticed between ideas or things or actions ordinarily treated as distinct." And he discusses this at length in that book if anyone wants to pick that up and explore more. But I think this is also something that's important to keep in mind. Yeah, it's not a one-to-one, but if it were a one-to-one, we probably wouldn't be doing a podcast about it.
Right. All right, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will talk about ant warriors in classic literature.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
All right, we're back. So we spent the whole first portion of this episode talking about the idea of comparing ant warfare to human warfare, and to what extent it's fair, what extent it makes sense, and ultimately it's irrelevant because we still do it, and we've been doing it for a very long time. We've been making that connection between human warfare and ant warfare, perhaps for as long as warriors have had a chance to pause on the battlefield and look down between their human feet and see a smaller version of their campaigns playing out in the dirt beneath them. For instance, if we look back to the Iliad, the specialized warriors who serve the mighty Achilles are known as the Myrmidons. The ant people is the literal translation of that.
Now, I know according to some mythological sources, the Myrmidons who fight with Achilles actually were ants at some point. Isn't that right? They were like transformed into human warriors from their ant origins.
Yeah, the tradition that we see in Ovid's Metamorphoses, for example, is that the gods transformed the ants into humans, and that's why they have these ant-like tendencies. They have this ant-like tenacity because they are essentially ants that were made human. But of course, that was not the actual reality. These were human troops, and we have to make some sort of sense of it. I was reading a 2010 paper published in The Classical World by Matthew Sears titled Warrior Ants, Elite Troops in the Iliad.
And he points out that masked fighting was probably the norm in the days of Homer, but that in this we get into scholarly conflict over the idea of the hoplite revolution and the pre-hoplite and hoplite warfare. Now, this refers to the Greek use of spears and shields and the phalanx formation. So this is kind of like an ant level of cooperation that stands in contrast to mass fighting and the dramatic single combat episodes of the Iliad. So the basic idea here is that the Myrmidons, as well as opposing soldiers under Ajax, might be understood as specialized warriors, professional soldiers who use this type of tight formation with the shields providing absolute support for the unit and the offensive spears used in a very deliberate manner as opposed to just a bunch of warriors running out and going at it. So definitely keep the phalanx in mind because we'll come back to it and discuss it more when we get into ant tactics a bit. But basically, on both sides of the conflict described in the Iliad, the idea is that you would have had a mix of such professional, highly trained fighters alongside more generalized troops. And of course, this would remain a reality in warfare for a long time. The professional soldiers fighting alongside the commoners, common men who have just been given arms or have taken up arms in the conquest. Now, in this, Sears goes, into a great deal more detail because it is primarily concerned with the ancient world. But he actually poses the question of whether ancient peoples without special lenses would have been able to mark the similarities between human and ant organized conflict. And based on the work of others, he says, we look at the traditions in Africa, Australia, and New Guinea in cases where you have people who have not used specialized gear to analyze ants, and they have long made these comparisons. Quote, the warlike characteristics of ants would have been just as apparent to the eyes of the ancient Greeks as they were to Thoreau and McCook. In short, the description of Achilles' men as ant people may be due to their resemblance in terms of ferocity, tactical ingenuity, unit cohesion, and general bellicosity to these insects as observed by the ancients.
Okay, so what makes them like ants? It's that they are fierce, that they execute tactics effectively, that they stick together and don't break up into individuals, and that they're very aggressive.
Yeah, they're not just I think sticking together and like working as a unit is key here. It's not the warfare of random battle. It's not the warfare of like the one hero fighting the other hero at the walls of Troy. No, it is about tactics and in uniform performance.
Exactly. And that is the advantage of the phalanx.
All right, so the next question folks might wonder is how long have ants waged these wars? Or maybe you haven't. Maybe you're not asking that question. But let me go and tell you, it's an interesting question with an interesting answer.
Tell us the answer, Robert.
All right. Well, first of all, let's consider the big picture first. We have to really stop and realize that we live in the world of the ant. Because today, the world is home to an estimated 22,000 species of ant. And of those, I've seen two different numbers for this, 12,500 or perhaps 13,000 have been classified or described. So we're still talking thousands of ant species out there that we just, don't have a good handle on, maybe don't even have names for. Now, according to Ted R. Schultz, in a 1997 paper on ant ancestors, ants probably account for 15 to 20% of the terrestrial animal biomass today.
So that means if you take all of the animals that live on land, and of course this doesn't include plants and stuff like that, but all the animals that live on land, you weigh them all together, this mm-hmm. estimate would say 15 to 20% of that is just ants.
Yeah, and apparently in areas where they're especially prominent, you could maybe be looking at 25%. Because they thrive everywhere. Like certainly they're around the equatorial belt, they're going to be especially active. But they thrive everywhere except Antarctica, and as well as the occasional far flung and inhospitable island. Otherwise, the ants just have it all locked down.
Now, that's an amazing estimate. And I do want to be fair. I've been reading around, and I think there are some disputes about exactly how much biomass ants account for. Different people have different estimates. But one other estimate I came across that was very interesting. It was quoted in a BBC article I was reading about ant biomass. It quotes Francis Ratneeks, who is a professor of apiculture at the University of Sussex. And Ratneeks was trying to address the question of what weighs more, all the ants or all the humans? And there have been different answers to this question. Ratneeks thinks that, well, now probably if you weighed up all the humans weigh more than the ants. But that hasn't always been the case. Definitely, Ratneek says, if you went back a few thousand years, ants would have far outweighed the humans. But as human populations have grown exponentially, especially in recent centuries, that changed. Ratneek thinks it was probably right around the late 1700s, or maybe a little bit before that, that the total weight of humans on Earth suddenly became larger than the total weight of ants. So around the time of American independence, the humans overtook the ants.
Wow. Now, here's another figure. And again, these are all estimates. So, you know,
yeah.
Don't, you know, have any particular factor like tattooed on your body regarding this. But the Field Museum has a wonderful ant page, an ant section of their website. Mm-hmm. And they make the claim that in the tropics, ant biomass outweighs all vertebrate life 2-1.
Yeah, and that emphasizes that, like, the percentage of ants as biomass is going to be heavily dependent on environment, right? So
yeah.
Around the equatorial regions where they're even more abundant, they might massively outweigh humans.
I mean, the take home is that basically, no matter how often we fail to notice ants in our environment, they are an extremely successful species. By some accounts, they are the most successful insect on the planet, which really puts them in consideration for the most successful animal on the planet.
Oh, yeah. I mean, insects dominate the animal world, and especially the terrestrial animal world. And if ants dominate the insects, I mean, I think you could absolutely make a good case there. But the funny thing is, you have to imagine, like all other organisms or families of organisms on Earth, there was a time when ants were newcomers on the evolutionary scene, and they can't always have had this occupied this elevated station.
That's right. They were not an overnight success. Ants evolved an estimated 140 to 168 million years ago. So they are ultimately a product of the Jurassic. But yeah, they were not an instant hit. I was reading that, scientists consider that they were probably like a modest success at first, ants were doing their thing, but they weren't just blowing up. Mm-hmm. But then something changed. Flowering and fruiting plants evolved an estimated 100 million years ago. And what this did is it transformed the energy economy. Insects suddenly had insects progressively had an entirely new food source to adapt to, a whole slew of new food sources. And so they did. And ants, which were, again, probably just a modestly successful life form at best earlier, suddenly exploded, filling out these various niches in the ecosystem. They adapted to a host of evolutionary niches and then spread across the two supercontinents of Eurasia and Gondwana.
I'm trying to imagine the scene of the first time some ants discovered a fallen fruit. What a sweet moment that would have been. It's almost like an ant Garden of Eden story.
Yeah. And it's like, it's just basically like all levels of this new fruit flower economy. Like the ants are there to figure out how to make it work and of course steadily evolve into these various species that that take advantage of it in various ways. Now, as Schultz points out, we don't have much evidence of ants from the first half of their existence. Not until the mid-Cretaceous do we see their fossil remains. But the evidence we have is pretty incredible. In 1966, E.O. Wilson and others identified the fossil remains of a Cretaceous ant species that was trapped in amber from 92 million years ago. But then there have been some more recent exciting findings. Ancient Burmese amber from Myanmar gives us even older evidence. I was reading about a 2016 study from Rutgers that was, at the time of that study, dated to 99 million years ago. And according to Philip Barden of the Insect and Evolution Lab and Jessica L. Ware of the Department of Biological Sciences at Rutgers University, Newark, what the contents of this chunk of amber show us is a frozen act of ant warfare.
Oh, I see it. They're in a tangle.
Yeah, it's two ants battling it out, duking it out, trapped forever in this this droplet of amber.
Well, I'm imagining a scene where the scientists from Jurassic Park drill into this amber and they use it to clone a dangerous Jurassic fruit. Right? They get the stomach content. I don't know if that joke connected. Oh, okay, whatever.
I get what you're cooking there.
Okay.
So the researchers, though, they do not go in that direction. What they say is that the ants trapped here belong to early ant lineages that are ultimately distinct from modern ants. So they're not really direct ancestors of modern ants. But in their study, they present evidence that these ancient ants were social and they were, you know, engaging in this kind of, collective conflict. Another bit of amber, they point out, contains some 21 worker ants. And this is from a time period in which, again, ant fossil evidence is super rare. So they say to get 21 in one blow suggests that they were already, you know, very social, working together. So we're looking at a good 100 million years of ant warfare based on this, you know, at least, more or less lining up with the advent of flowering and fruiting plants, with true dominance of the ants being reached some 60 million years ago. Now, other things, of course, evolved as well, including some of their various features. Interestingly enough, some of the ancient ants were rather brutal looking, even more brutal looking than they look today. For instance, there were the hell ants, so named because they feature many characteristics that some might, you know, consider unusual or hellish.
Yeah, I found out because you linked it to this one called Lingua Myrmex Vladi, and I was looking at that name for a second and I was thinking, wait, Vladi, that can't be. Is it? Is it Vlad? Is it Vlad the Impaler?
It is named for Vlad the Impaler because it has this unique head structure where it has it's kind of difficult to describe because it has like this paddle-like projection on it, and X-ray imaging reveals that it was most probably filled with sequestered metals to make it fortified.
Wow!
And that it would have worked in tandem with scythe-like mandibles to pin and potentially puncture soft-bodied prey. So it was this real bear trap of a head on this thing.
I'm looking at images of it now. It is a brutal spike coming out of the head.
Yeah. Now, this isn't to say there aren't some really gnarly ant heads around today. We'll get back to some of those later on. But one of the important take-homes from all of this, and this is something that Sean O'Donnell points out in that Serious Science article on ant wars, he points out that there's an important shift in the weaponry of ants across time. So long ago, vertebrates were probably the biggest threat to ants, so they were more equipped to deal with them via things like a powerful sting. But as time passed and they spread across the world, they become more and more successful, pressure on each other becomes more prevalent. In other words, the endless ant wars become more important for shaping their evolution than the dinosaurs, the birds, and the various mammals that preyed on them.
So they used to have to be more worried about anteaters and armadillos getting in there and vacuuming them up with the snout. But over time, their real adversaries become the rival hymenopteran colonies.
Exactly. So ultimately, some ant lineages end up keeping their sting. For example, the bullet ant, whose bite ranks as a 4, that's the maximum score on Schmidt's sting pain index. I was reading a description. This is by Justin O. Schmidt, the entomologist who came up with this system of measuring the stings. He described it as, quote, pure, intense, brilliant pain, like walking over flaming charcoal with a 3-inch nail embedded in your heel.
Yeah, I've read descriptions of this one as well. The only other thing that I recall being compared to this level of pain with a sting was the tarantula hawk.
Yeah,
which is a type of stinging wasp, but apparently it is just like unimaginable in terms of an insect sting.
So that's an example of ants that have kept their impressive bioweapon, but others lost it entirely. And in some cases, these systems adapted into chemical weapon systems to be used against other ants. And we'll discuss those later on in this this look at ant warfare, because it ends up taking a different form, because ultimately you're trying to solve different problems at different scales with different enemies.
Okay, looks like it's time for us to take a break, but we'll be right back with more.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So we've now come to the portion of our episodes here where we're going to really get into the endless wars of Antkind and the sorts of tactics they employ on the battlefield. And we're probably not going to be able to make it all the way through this next section without having to stop the episode and come back in part two. But if everything goes according to plan, you're only going to have to wait like a day for the Ant Wars to continue. Now, the most important fact to drive home first is that naturally there are so many species of ants to consider, and that a specific species' tactics are then also going to change depending on circumstances, and this is just going to be the nature of war. Moffat writes that some ants succeed in battle by being on constant offensive, and he draws an interesting comparison here to a 6th century BCE Chinese military general Sun Tzu, who also noted that, quote, rapidity is the essence of war.
Right. I mean, so much depends on your ability to not give your opponent time to react effectively.
Right. And so, like, the key variety of ant to draw a comparison here too, he says, would be the army ants that inhabit warm regions around the world, as well as Asia's marauder ants as prime examples here. For these ant legions, hundreds or even millions of these warriors will advance in a tight phalanx against their ant adversaries.
Now, I guess we should try to examine what that would mean for ants as opposed to human warriors. So if you're like an ancient Greek phalanx, this would involve, say, staying together in a tight formation with a wall of shields out in front that sort of like prevents the enemy from reaching you, and that you would have trained to be able to move forward and thrust with spears in an organized fashion all together, minimizing the chances for the enemy to break into you while you're pushing into them.
Yeah, like basically the difference between like just two hordes like just slamming into each other and having something more in keeping with really what we see in the tradition of tabletop wargaming. For anyone out here there has actually played any of these games, you can certainly relate. But even if you've looked at one, you get a sense of order. And I think that's what draws players into it, right? You have all these little individual soldiers that are part of different units, and these units are working together. You're having to employ a strategy to deploy them and then move them around and counter the movements of your adversary. And again, for a human, this is done by, you know, either the godlike figure that looms over the gaming table, or it is the domain of a commander. But for the ants, it is just that pure swarm intelligence that allows it to take place. Now, Moffat points out for human forces, just advancing in a phalanx, part of the issue here is you need to know where you're going, right? Which I guess is obvious. Yeah. Your phalanx needs to have a target or goal or purpose, like cutting its way through the defenses in order to get to the gates of Troy, that sort of thing. But some ants, however, just kind of stick to this roving phalanx tactic, just a roving, decimating horde that brings to mind, I'd say, like the Tyranid army from Warhammer 40,000 might be an example of this, you know, or various sort of alien bio adversaries in science fiction, where it's just this massive horde that's working in unity and it's difficult to stop, right? However, human forces, you know, tend not to go this route. They tend to depend on scouts as well to determine where to apply that offensive pressure, where to send your phalanx. And some ants do this as well. Some species will send out a small team of workers to serve as scouts. But this too is risky, as a risky strategy for ants, because a team of scouts, they have to report back to the colony in order for a larger force to then return to obtain that food source that they just scouted. And this is true of human scouts as well in a military scenario. We might well consider the case of Imperial probe droids, for example, right? In Empire Strikes Back.
Mm-hmm.
You send out these droids, and yeah, one may discover a rebel base on Hoth, but it actually needs to survive and then get word back to the Empire so they can deploy their AT-ATs, their massive army. Likewise, the Empire would find this to be a better method. Send out the probe droids because we can't send the AT-ATs to every world just in case there's a rebel base there.
Right.
So basically, for the Empire, for the ants as well, it basically means that you can depend on you can send out fewer ants and cover a larger area in order to scout out potential targets, in the case of the ants, potential food.
Now, I can imagine, though, there are a lot of considerations that must be built into ant behavior based on not wasting resources on, like, you know, going somewhere where there's no longer anything useful to be done, right?
Yeah, because there's always the risk that the enemy will move before a larger force can arrive, or that food source that was scouted out is just not going to be there when your ant troops roll in. And in all of this, for the ants, pheromones are key for their communication here. The scouts use this to tag the food source for the larger force to find.
So so the pheromones of the ants here would be the Imperial probe droids, kind of message that it sends out.
Yeah, basically, like the pheromones end up serving as communication lines. Moffat writes that, quote, "The workers of the army ants or marauder ants can immediately summon any help they require because a slew of assistants are marching directly behind them. The result is maximal shock and awe."
So much like in more large-scale conflicts, you'd have to in some way ensure that communication lines are able to remain open for forces to be effective.
Exactly. And again, here, you know, for the ants, it is largely this realm of touch and smell. It's the pheromonal information that's so key. So really, I feel like this at this point in the podcast, I think we do have a pretty, you know, broad view of like what's going on with the ant war effort, about how troops are distributed, how communication is taking place, and then how offensive pressure can be applied to different areas depending on the need.
Oh, but there is so much more ant battle to talk about.
Yes, indeed there is. We were only able to get through like the first half of our material here because there's a lot more about, well, just about like the at the individual level, there's a lot more about like the, how like ant jaws work, the power of ant bioweapons, et cetera. But then also when you get into the marauder ant specifically, there's been a lot of wonderful work regarding just how they carry out their campaigns and to what extent we can compare these acts of ant conquest to actual human battles.
Well, I can't wait to come back next time and fight on with the Myrmidons.
Yeah, more ants, more allusions to Star Wars and various tabletop gaming scenarios. It's going to be a lot of fun. In the meantime, if you would like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you know where to find us, and that is wherever you get your podcasts. Wherever that happens to be, what strange service you depend on for your podcast delivery, just make sure you rate, review, and subscribe, because that really helps us out in the long run.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.